getting the development of very specific drugs that'll target specific defects in the brain biochemistry that are going to, you know, really help people out a lot and not cause all the side effects that used to cause people not to want to seek psychiatric help.
You've been in this business for a number of years, 30 years. How you really help people in this business? What percentage of people do you think really get significant help who come to your ward?
Well, I think our inpatient setting is only one aspect of the support systems that people need to get help. I mean, we're a very short-term stay. People rarely stay at our facility more than 5 or 6 days. 80% of the people that come to my facility come on what's called a 5150 hold because they're dangerous to themselves or suicidal or they're threatening people out in the community. They have a psychosis that's causing them to be very paranoid and, you know, they may be.
Some merchants don't like them hanging around the shop.
Well, and this is a problem that we saw with the homeless in Santa Barbara a lot, that in fact, you know, it's unfortunate that people can't get access to treatment or, you know, and that they're very stigmatized in the community. I personally feel that the old system where people were kept in psychiatric facilities for months and years at a time was really pretty damaging to people, and that, you know, it's interesting. I think what's happened is with the closure of all the mental hospitals, particularly the state mental hospital systems, places like the Salvation Army and Catholic Charities have now become more like the mini mental hospitals. Only people are out in the community, and they have freedoms, and it's a much improved system, but it still has its deficits because people still are often not getting the medications that they need or the nutrition that they need or the care that they need because they simply can't afford it. You know, some of these medications are very expensive. And the newer medications are not covered, for example, by the Medi-Cal formulary. So people that are poor are still continuing to have two levels of care in psychiatry where the rich people can take advantage of the new drugs that don't have side effects, but because they're so costly, Zyprexa, for instance, is a very costly drug, treats psychosis very well. People can recompensate within a few days and go back to work and get back to the community if they've had a psychotic break, but they can't access that medication because Medi-Cal won't pay for it.
Well, again, the question I have, being an old Thomas Zaz man myself,
The myth of mental illness, you mean, Robert?
Yeah, that's the very man. He wrote a book by that label, and being an old Napa graduate, that's Network Against Psychiatric Assault, from your own Berkeley from the 70s, the one city that banned electroshock for 1 year, a small victory, but certainly a victory of sorts. What good do you do? I guess he's saying you send people back to work who have, quote, psychotic breaks. But looking at the percentage of people who come into your program, how many of them do you think experience long-term benefits? The whole terminology, medication, care, access, it's a bunch of buzzwords. But my question to you is, how many people do you really help? Percentage-wise?
I think, you know, that the myth of mental illness that Thomas Zaz has written about may apply in some conditions, social conditions of poverty where people are under a great deal of stress and may have depression and so on related to that. I mean, I think there are a lot of conditions where if you take the social conditions and you improve them, people's mental health will improve and they'll feel better. On the other hand, having worked in this field for 30 years, you know, I have come across many, many people that actually need treatment, and to withhold treatment from someone who is incontinent, psychotic, confused, thinking, you know, that their toothbrush is a brush that they comb their hair with, where they cannot find their womb because their psychosis is so bad, where they're urinating on themselves, where they're defecating on themselves, smearing their feces. You know, people like this need to be treated, and to withhold treatment from them is criminal. You know, and in fact, untreated psychosis produces in the body steroids, you know, the body will produce steroids that in and of themselves can be brain damaging. So you need to treat psychosis. You know, if on the other hand, not all psychiatric conditions need treatment with medication. Many of them can be helped with counseling, psychotherapy, or just getting in a good relationship and, you know, a week at the beach. A weekend at the beach, you know, can, like, help a lot of conditions.
So how, we could turn to your condition, but that's another story. So in other words, there actually is such a thing called psychosis, which you can, shall we say, identify by physical symptomology, which if, quote, untreated, whatever that may mean, leads to the production of steroids in the body. Are we actually making this as a serious scientific claim?
Yeah, there's some good valid research to indicate that. Yeah.
I will investigate this further and see as to what this psychiatric hack is talking about here.
You know, and believe it or not, Robert, ECT or shock treatment can be a very effective treatment for the treatment of depression. I see you getting a little sweaty over here. I'm not going to do it to you, Robert. But particularly the elderly who can't tolerate antidepressant medications can be positively helped with ECT. You know, people that haven't been able to get out of bed for months at a time. You know, that may be wasting away. You know, we get people that haven't been able to eat, sleep for weeks and months at a time, haven't been able to work for a year or two. They get a series of maybe 10 shock treatments and, you know, they're feeling a lot better. They're eating again, they're drinking again, they're able to go out and work. Mm-hmm. So,
you know. Well, I know that it was very effective with elderly oxen in Italy in the late 30s. Hang on, we have an incoming call here.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, I couldn't resist it. I was in the state hospital you know, in San Jose for a long time ago. And I observed the people who were given ECT. They did snap out of whatever, you know, they were being in, you know, they were in, committed to the hospital for. And they, a lot of them were older women. They'd snap out of it, and then they'd lapse back. Have to have more treatments, more treatments, more treatments. It was like a never-ending trip. And I just think it's wrong, and it's dangerous, and it's... I'm not... That's my input, okay?
What year were you in this hospital?
Let's see, 60... Agnes State Hospital, and it's 68... 69, something like that.
So that
I was only 17 years old.
Mm-hmm. But that was 30 years ago.
Yeah. And but I was in and out of that place for 3 years. Huh. So I knew it well.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure. Go ahead. Jane has a question for you, caller. Can you hear us?
I can hear you over the radio.
Yeah, you'll be able to hear us.
Oh, okay.
Everywhere.
Hi. What's your name?
Gloria.
Gwen?
Yeah, Gloria.
Oh, Gloria. Gloria.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I do want to say about ECT, it's a treatment of last resort. It's not something that I'm, and of course I'm not a psychiatrist. I have a master's degree in psychiatric nursing and a PhD in education. But I really think that, you know, you have to very carefully scrutinize criteria for determining whether or not somebody's appropriate for ECT. And the ECT that they used to do back in the 60s is very different than how it's administered and managed today.
Yeah, I heard about
it's new and improved.
It is new and improved, and it doesn't cause the loss of memory that old treatment used to do. People recover very quickly from the ECT. You know, it's they don't have seizures like they used to. It's really, but again, as far as our facility is concerned. The number of people that actually get ECT is very small in proportion to the whole population there that's being treated, maybe 5%.
You know,
but anyway, I had a question for you, Gloria. Having been in the state hospital for 3 years back in the 1960s, what happened in your life to help you get out of the hospital and stay out of the hospital?
can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. They kicked me out. They were realizing that I was becoming institutionalized after a year and a half. And they had me on medications and in therapy, kept changing the medications and they were basically, the doctor had the foresight to know that I better get out of there and into the community. So I went to a halfway house, then back into the state hospital. It just was like a gradual weaning myself. You know, it took, but overall it was 3 years.
Uh-huh.
But just different times that I was there. But I still have, you know, some problems that have caused a problem. I just think it's a permanent addiction to Valium.
Hmm.
And that's a lot better than Melaril.
Yeah. How much are you using?
30 to 40
milligrams
a day. That's what my psychiatrist said was allowable.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I mean,
do you feel like you're in trouble with it now?
No, I don't want to have to give it up.
Right.
It's very expensive. It's not covered by Medi-Cal.
Uh-huh.
And the generic doesn't work the same.
Huh.
That's the brand name, of course.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, Xanax is the same thing.
Well, you know, the main things with Valium that you need to be watching for, as far as, of course, you know, it is a benzodiazepine where, you know, it has a potential for addiction. So, you know, I mean, to just sort of check on yourself is to watch, you know, are you taking more than the doctor's prescribing? Or are you, you know, shopping to, you know, going around and doctor shopping and getting Valium from this one and that one and the other one and using more than you feel you should? Are you having, you know, difficulty with cognition as far as your thinking is concerned? Sometimes people get, you know, one of the things about Valium, it has a longer half-life than some of the other shorter-acting benzodiazepines, so sometimes it can build up in your system a little bit. But on the other hand, if it's keeping you out of the hospital and you're able to function, you know, and it's not causing all the side effects that things like Melaril do, you know. It's,
and think of the benefit you're providing to the pharmaceutical industry executives who need those vacations and those extra perks. I think perhaps doubling your Valium a day might be a positive approach to that.
Right.
Is there anything more you want to comment on, caller?
I found that none of the antidepressants...
Say that again?
None of the antidepressants that... The last one I was taking was Prozac.
Uh-huh.
None is effective. There are none.
So it sounds like you have an anxiety disorder more so than a depression.
It's both. Yeah. It's alternating.
So what else do you do for yourself, for your mental health?
I have my little regimen, you know. I have ways of handling things, but every once in a while I find that it's not a matter of my environment or anything except an internal chemistry of menopause.
Yeah.
You know, hormonal changes. So I've been taking care of myself, but I have a long standing history of, you know, being in hospitals for suicide attempts.
Uh-huh.
And I know it from a different angle than, well, you know, some of the patients, some of the doctors.
So have you stopped that suicidal ideation? Has that been... Is that
mainly
under control?
Mainly medication.
Say that again?
Different medications.
Have helped you.
That I, you know, can... Well, actually, it is better with the hormones.
Oh, well, that's good. See, there are a lot of women don't realize that depression and menopause go hand in hand.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There are a lot of things that... Yeah. You know, one of the things that I personally have found very effective is there's a little natural cream that you can get at the health food store called Progest Cream that's natural. It's natural progestin. It doesn't progesterone. It doesn't have some of the side effects that estrogen can have. You know, people get worried about it, breast cancer and things
really
like that with estrogen. But
I have a very good, effective natural.
And then, you know, people don't realize it, but eating soy products can be very, very good for hormonal imbalances when you're going through menopause. You know, soybeans, and Robert wants to grab the microphone away from me because he's obviously uncomfortable with the topic of menopause.
Well, I have my own menopausal problems, my own crisis of life. I was going to suggest extensive sexual behavior of a liberating sort.
Right.
Which I found very positive in many respects. But then again, that's a more of a personal preference. And the reason
somewhat actually, male response.
Male response. Well, of course, men have a men are different, as you know.
Oh, really?
Well, longer organs, darker hair. it's kind of a difficult situation to describe on the air. Well, caller,
I'll let you go.
Listen, no, I don't mean to cut you off.
I don't want to stop this from turning into a
kind of a personalized treatment program, which I'll be happy to hook you up with Jane at a later time.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure she has very reasonable rates and can minister to you effectively. But I am, of course, concerned with the public issues of, you know, just how much sending voltage through the brain actually helps. Jane, of course, is a part of an administration that does this, and I don't know if she would feel free to criticize this if she felt it was a crock of shit or perhaps a shock of shit. I'm not quite sure how we'd put it. Jane, would you feel free to say ECT sucks if, in fact, you felt that way and maintain your position?
I feel that if my mother had an unrelenting, unremitting depression that was life-threatening, that was not responding to medications, treatment, wonderful sex, etc., Robert, and it was completely impairing her ability to function as a human being, I would be supportive of her getting ECT.
That's not my question. My question is, would your superiors keep you in your present position if you decided ECT sucked?
In fact, I manage the ECT program. We'll screen out employees who ethically don't want to work in ECT. It's completely their right. You know, just like working in a hospital, you know, if a hospital performs abortions or a clinic performs abortions, I would never force an employee who ethically felt it was against her ethical principles to participate in doing abortions. You know, I wouldn't fire someone for that ever, just like I don't, you know, ever expect my nurses who ethically feel that ECT is not right or a good way to go. I wouldn't chastise them or discipline them for not agreeing to work in ECT. Here, Robert, take it back.
That, again, was not really my question. My question was, and again I repeat it, would you be able to keep your present position if you took a Peter Bragan opposition to ECT?
Who's Peter Bragan?
We'll answer that question after we take this next phone call.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi. Before I tell you the two things I wanted to say, I'd like to acknowledge that it's real good to hear women on Free Radio talking about women's stuff, like sexuality and menopause. It hardly ever happens. Thank you so much. It was a real surprise on Robert's show, too.
Well, women are invited to come on my show. There's been some rumors that I'm hostile to women.
They've just been censored about talking about menopause, and they've been co-opted when talking about sexuality. That might be an exaggeration, but it felt like that.
Well, let me give you back to Jane to continue to talk about sexuality.
Well, I have other announcements to make, too.
Oh, good.
I'm real interested in what she was saying about mental health. I want to remind anybody listening that new state law requires that you don't get to pick who your doctor's going to be if you need mental health care. You don't get to pick your practitioner. So that means I don't have any access whatsoever in this county to a psychiatrist.
Well, who are you seeing? I mean, if you wanted to see.
Well, basically, I've gone through a year and a half in my life where it was hard to even keep appointments. But I've been recently taken in as a client for the State Department of Voc Rehab.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, they think I need a lot of counseling.
Yeah.
And maybe they're right. I don't know. I think I need about half as much. My counseling about my bad attitude, I don't really
Definitely
want to embrace.
Bad attitude, no question.
Well, let me be honest with you. Unfortunately, what's happened in the mental health field today is psychiatrists have been relegated to the role of essentially assessment of patients, doing psychiatric assessments, and pretty much administering or ordering medications. This is part of the HMO problem, as far as I'm concerned. Managed care.
It's the state politics of deliberately sectioning out mental health care from other health care 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe 7, I don't know for sure. And then this recent thing I just mentioned, and all kinds of little steps in between that have politically devalued the access that poor and working people have to health care.
That's right.
And you add that to the local politics, well, for I just know this county, there isn't an independent psychiatrist that the court will even accept to assess somebody. You know, they took the license away from the only one guy who was willing to be independent and still work and still take Medi-Cal people.
Well, I think the HMO, the whole HMO system with the insurance companies and the healthcare industry are really forcing physicians into joining, these group practices that are, that the HMOs are controlling. And I think that a lot of guys, are no longer being paid for seeing patients and doing psychotherapy. I have a friend who is an excellent psychotherapist, and he was a psychiatrist down in Santa Barbara, who's left the profession because he simply can't practice anymore the way he wants to. You know, his practice is being controlled by HMOs. And, I know that for myself, when I used to, try to have to call these HMOs to get approval to get a patient hospitalized or treated, it was appalling. I'd be speaking to someone in New Jersey that maybe had a bachelor's degree in, or one course in psychology, 101, and they were determining whether or not this patient was deserving of hospital treatment or not. And so I'd have to spend an hour on the phone with someone who had no clue about psychiatric care, trying to convince them of the need for hospitalization. So I really feel what we need, homeless rights are important, but I also feel that homeless are prevented from, and poor are prevented from accessing healthcare services, and that the HMO system is really a disgrace to this country, and that people should really be creating grassroots movements here to fight the HMOs.
And I think it's really important that that movement consists of the doctors and care providers,
absolutely,
as well as the people who have already been totally or badly victimized.
That's right.
I mean, you also meet people who used to be practicing psychologists on the street, that there's no shelter they can go in unless they want to forfeit their physical health, here anyway.
Right.
So there's also something I wanted to announce. The Central Coast Center for Independent Living, which is like a advocacy group for disabled people, including head injury, they're having something called Self-Advocacy Workshop. It says, presented by the Client Assistance Program. And it's on Thursday, August 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. It's in the United Way Meeting Room, which is on 41st Avenue. CECL is the acronym, Central Coast Center for Independent Living. Looking for a phone number. Oh, here we go. 462-8720. And it has a deadline, but I called after that deadline, so apparently they're still taking people if you want to register. And this says, if you are a person with a disability, a Voc Rehab client, or would like to become a client, please join us. If you need an ASL or Spanish interpreter or any accommodations for the workshop, contact Richard at 462-8720. And I want to go because it doesn't seem like the numerous bureaucracies, just in as I present myself the last 6 months to Voc Rehab, connect.
Right. Well, one of the things that I wanted to go back to what you were saying before is that, you feel you can't access a psychiatrist anymore. There are other professionals besides psychiatrists, like licensed clinical social workers, MFCCs, people like that who are really excellent at providing counseling and psychotherapy.
I've got a better chance of ambushing someone on the sidewalk and asking them out to coffee or lunch who don't know that I know what their job is than to get an appointment through the county system.
That's
if you're not already on drugs, they don't take you for a patient until you come in and start threatening to hurt somebody. And then they put you in jail, like what Robert was talking about of Chris Brozda. So, I mean, there's no way, if you're not already deemed nuts, to get mental health care here, unless somebody comes in with private money.
Well, keep working on that. It sounds like getting on the air and talking about it and getting other people in the same situation together to, go to the powers that be to complain. I mean, it's really important, and I think it goes back to, the cuts in funding for mental health on the state level and the national level, and the fact that mental health simply is not given parity. They don't think that treating somebody for schizophrenia is as important as treating somebody for heart disease, when in fact schizophrenia or major depression can be more life-threatening and interfere with one's ability to function and work and feel good about themselves, and perhaps heart disease. But
so are you saying sort of that we should just go along with these popular prejudices, even
no.
when we see our peers being killed or worse?
Absolutely not.
Because
you know,
I feel like if anybody were doing any sort of accountability, that alone would shake people, at least in the legislature, out of their thinking they have to go along with this just because there's a bunch of bigotry on the loose. Because
right.
that's what you were describing, and that's what I've experienced.
Yeah,
here.
Destigmatizing mental illness is really, really an important thing to do, you know, because people have terrible stereotypes about the mentally ill, and you
and
know,
being
just
encouraged right now.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's
very
like unfortunate.
It's like the hate crime pattern. It's like it's okay even to be a county employee and sit around out loud talking about people, or even shooting them. The police department shot somebody in this town, primarily, I think, because he was an undercared for person with special health care needs.
Right.
And it's common. It's rampant.
That's right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Also, I want to let you know that on the subject of menopause, you know, I've read the books I could get hold of, and I guess they were some help. They helped me decipher the herbs and drugs I'm taking, at least. But there's this wonderful video that you can get, and you can borrow it free. And I can't remember the title, but you can get the information here from Walnut Avenue Women's Center or from Elena Smith. And it's just an incredible panoply of women who are going through it or who have recently been through it. Some of them live in the Oakland area and in Santa Cruz. I recognize some of the people. But the way this videographer made this movie is like a series of interviews interspersed with sort of natural scenes, you know, and helping us understand this isn't like the flag of old age. It's like another transition.
That's right.
A transition that has its own kinds of beauty.
Menopause can be fun.
Well, it sure has liberated the other half of the month as far as sexuality goes. I mean,
I'm
a different person that I don't have to spend half my adult life
birth control
wondering if I'm pregnant or
not. That's right. All right.
And that's not to say I haven't tried every birth control.
Let's hear it for women over 50.
Hey.
All right.
What about men over 50?
Thank
those
you.
Those two. Better catch up. Let's
you know
pray
that
for them.
You're just 2 weeks older than me. We're both Geminis and born in 1947.
Wow.
All right. So, listen, I have to leave, but it was really enjoyable talking to you, and it sounds
thank
like you're
you,
a great wealth of information. And, yeah, keep fighting for your rights.
All right.
Yeah, and we're going to call you back, Linda, to talk to you about the welfare scene. So stay near your radio. We're talking, of course, to Lighthouse Linda LeMaster. Hi, Linda.
Oh, darn. You gave me
Linda,
my hat back.
I met you years ago.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking when you reminded Robert that you met him here at our town clock when they kidnapped Mitch.
Yeah.
There was a sign at that demonstration by this guy, John, I can't remember his last name. It said, healthcare without mental health strings. Healthcare without mental health strings. And that was in a homeless gathering, that sign, because at that time, the only way you could get shelter was to confess as a dual diagnosis person. Huh. Whether that's how you saw yourself or not didn't even matter. This the county wanted to get its chunk of money.
That's
so
interesting.
I think it's still an issue.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm going to play a little music now, Linda, then I'm going to get back to you. So stay by your phones and ask for the rest of you eager callers. I think you're missing your opportunity to get a hold of Jane Hagstrom, but I will try to get a hold of her for you. Thank you, and hang on and hang tough.
We're on the air with David Silva. Hi, David.
Well, hi, Robert. How are you? I was calling back because I was thinking a little bit more about this Miguel Gutierrez, you know, putting him down or putting him up for attempted murder. It's one of the things that we got in front of church today. Some of the people who were a little less educated to this situation say, oh, well, that Beach Flats, yeah, you can't even walk down there. And most of the parishioners turned to them, what are you talking about? Beach Flats is a good neighborhood. It's a good, safe place to walk. And so the most of the parishioners have it, but some still don't. But now with this murder, attempted murder trial of a Latino in the Beach Flats, that's got to be a nice image for them to be able to project across the media. It's too bad they have to martyr a very, very sweet, dear loving, you know, good quality student that does a lot of charity work and so forth. I think they picked the wrong guy, because the whole Catholic community is going to be rising up, and I wish the radical community would go to the trial next Monday. And like I said, I'll tell you exactly what time. Another thing that Peace and Justice Commission for the whole Northern County Catholic churches are doing is asking people that belong to organizations to ask your organizations to see if they could sponsor a family. There's 200 families out on strike. Well, actually, it's a work stoppage. The rapini crops and all the broccoli and all the mustard and many of those crops, another 800, the Dorigio farms, will be going out. So there is a need for people to get their organizations to start calling the farm workers, see if you can sponsor a family, because those people are going without food. There's some deals where they can get beans and rice for 10 cents a pound, so if you send money, it really turns around fast, real well. Call 763-4904. You know, help the farm workers. This is now. It's time. You know, the time has come. It doesn't look like there's going to be a strawberry boycott. If anything, there's probably going to be a broccoli boycott, and it's coming upon them fast. The Italian families, the old Italian families, just are set in their ways. This contract has been negotiating for 18 years, and now when they brought these machines in that make them work 10 hours for less than 8 hours pay, that was enough. You know. Anyway, encouraging everybody to get in touch with the organizations and make sure the organizations can help the farm workers, and also show up for. Miguel Gutierrez's trial next Monday. We gotta let him know what we think about this kind of using people. It's using a racial thing and accusing somebody that's defending himself with a racial attack of attempted murder. You know, and then having it staged in the Beats Flats and how it looks on the media. It's just all too disgusting. I think we all let the judge know that Danner and all the politicos need to stop playing with people's lives. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, your favorite station and mine. This is Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the final 20 minutes. We're on every Sunday at 11 in the morning and every Thursday night at 6 in the evening. I want to remind all you programmers to show up at our next Free Radio Santa Cruz meeting tomorrow night or lose your slot. And for those of you who want to get a space on Free Radio, and there are spaces available, give a call to the voicemail at 427-4523. That's 427-4523. Email if you want, frsc@cruzio.com, or drop us a letter, and possibly a letter with a large fat check at Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. No checks necessary, however, if you want to be a part of the collective, prepare a tape that is taped on both sides so we can get a sense of what kind of program you want to put on. We are not really that censorious, but we do have some standards, and we're interested in knowing whether you're just babbling, ranting and raving, or talking about something, or playing some music. It can be, we have a very wide latitude. I want to apologize to local, I guess he's not an activist these days, he wouldn't call himself an activist, but he's certainly a public speaker and a talk show host, Steve Hartman of radio station, is it KOMY? I can never get the new talk numbers right. It's the KSCO local spinoff. Steve was gracious enough to grant me an interview this morning when I called him, and I now find I am out of time, and I'm going to have to pass on this interview and play it on Thursday. It's about the Beach Flats and a number of other subjects. In fact, I'm even hoping to lure Steve into the studio where he can help field a few calls, maybe get him into a debate. Steve has generously offered to invite the Bears on his radio show on KSCO, for which I thank him. He's already had Rotkin on, so he can't get much lower than that. Bears will add hopefully if they accept, will add some positive aspects. And I'm never quite sure whether his show is Monday or Tuesday at noon or Thursday or Friday at noon. So the best thing to do is to check noon on those 4 days and see when his show is on. I remind you the call-in number here is 427-3772 in case you want to get in on the action. And I'm your host, Bathrob's Pierre Robert Norse. Now, before we leave the air, I have this article, which I was going to read to you from the San Francisco Chronicle, and then get local comment from our welfare wizard, Linda LeMaster, who you heard talking on the air to Jane Hagstrom a few minutes ago. This is an article in the Thursday, August 20th Chronicle. The headline is Figures Show Welfare Reform Working in Larger Cities. And it's by Judith Haberman of the Washington Post, probably a condensation of a larger article. Washington, independent researchers have found the first solid evidence that welfare reform is beginning to work in the nation's largest cities, federal officials announced yesterday. While the welfare rolls have declined by nearly 4 million individuals since President Clinton signed dramatic overhaul legislation 2 years ago this Saturday, the biggest drops have occurred in rural states and suburban communities. In Los Angeles, however, home to more welfare recipients than 48 of the 50 states, recipients who were subject to the requirements of reform were far more successful at getting jobs and more significantly made money than recipients who were not, according to Manpower Demonstration Research Corp., a noted New York research group. Noted by who, of course, we don't know. The researchers found that 43% of poor families who were required to participate in the city's new welfare reform program got jobs, while only 32% of families randomly selected to remain in the traditional welfare program did. This represents an increase of one-third over the old welfare program. The typical welfare family subject to the reform incentives earned $1,286 in the first 6 months of the program, while control group families earned $879, a difference of over 46%. The study covered a period from 1996 to 1997. Up to now, many of the early results from welfare reform have been attributed to the robust economy and to, quote, creaming, the tendency for the most able and well-educated recipients to leave the rolls on their own and get jobs without much state intervention. But Los Angeles provides the first hard evidence that welfare reform is beginning to touch the inner city, where many of the most disadvantaged recipients are clustered. Los Angeles County, which has 750,000 people on welfare, the largest caseload in the nation after the states of California and New York, required recipients to attend job orientation sessions, look for work, participate in job clubs, work with job counselors, and cluck like a chicken. I'm sorry, that's just a small addition on my part. These activities have become central features of most states' efforts to carry out the federal welfare law. Most of the recipients included in the study had only a 10th grade education. More than a third had not worked within the past 2 years. Nearly half had never been married, and 1 in 5 had a limited proficiency in English. No other large city has ever shown results like this, said Lawrence Mead, professor of politics at NYU and author of a recent book on welfare reform. Other researchers pointed out that while Los Angeles has been more successful than other big cities, most recipients were still not working. We should exercise caution here, said Toby Hare, director of Project Match in Chicago. If we know we can get 43% to work, what percentage can we keep working, and how can we shorten the interval between jobs? The federal law requires recipients to work, puts limits on how long someone can receive benefits, and gives states broad latitude to design their own programs. Since an overhaul of the welfare system was signed into law 2 years ago, California has cut the number of people on its rolls from 2,019,702 from 2,581,948, a decrease of 21.8%, according to figures released yesterday by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That compares with a 32% decline nationwide. Caseloads have fallen 41.3% since their peak in 1994. And that, again, is a story by Judith Haberman of the Washington Post. Figures show welfare reform working in larger cities in the San Francisco Chronicle of August 20th. And I'm now attempting to reach Linda LeMaster by phone and getting her answering machine. Hopefully we can actually, I think we now have her on the phone.
Hello, Linda.
Hello? Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can't hear the radio suddenly.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. You're
now
on
the
radio.
Now you're gone again.
Well, okay, let's do it like this.
Now I hear you.
So what do you think of this story by Judith Haberman of the Washington Post? Of course, it's coming out on the second anniversary of the welfare deformation program, as I call it, or welfare reform, as they call
it.
Yeah. What's your analysis?
Well, I have some sort of technical or specific reactions to it, but I'm not buying that particular study they cite there shows something new and different. Because the people I know who are off of welfare were people with newborns who weren't on it very long, who stayed on it for 6 months, and then when they were told, come here and do our work fare routine, they had to stop because there's no child care person. You know some of these people I'm referring to. I know two families in this situation, one in San Francisco and one in Santa Cruz. So, you know, I believe that people who might get a job because they're getting temporary support from the workfare part of what we have called welfare reform, wrongly called it, are of course going to have an easier time getting a job or a training position when they're getting the support services it requires. So if that survey does mean anything, even though I don't believe it does, what it means won't be known until we see if they can hold their jobs when the child care or the transportation vouchers or gas or, you know, whatever, because it's different in every state. I think a very dangerous thing would be to take some of these survey results and try to apply them to these nationwide programs after our government has gone to sort of bend over backwards to encourage the states to try as many different things as they want. I mean, you know, the first two waivers included real serious ruthlessness against their people. And that was right at the time that the general assistance benefits were becoming no longer mandated, and so places like Michigan just stopped having it altogether. Places like Oakland tried to stop and lead the state in cutting back a program that already didn't pay for what it claims it's for, was inadequate for the half a room and some food that it's supposed to pay for. So, I mean, I don't want to get off on general assistance. People use the word welfare loosely through most of society, and they don't know what they're talking about, let alone what the person they're talking to is talking about, unless they make it real clear.
You know, maybe we can do we only have about 10 minutes left, and I want you to keep talking about this, and I've got some questions for you, but maybe we can do a broader show, since this is the second anniversary of the Clinton sellout on welfare. We can do some special, you can do a special report for us on Thursday as to what's really happening in Santa Cruz County, both around general assistance, around the kind of medical services and mental health.
I'll give it a try.
And also from around welfare. I know that we had a lot of concern 2 years ago, and there were a lot of predictions there would be a massive increase of homeless on the streets. And I'm simply, you know, not in a position to tell, but I have not been able to determine specifically larger numbers of homeless people or smaller numbers. I mean, it's hard to get a
Robert,
fix on
you're
it.
A homeless activist.
Exactly.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, what's your reading on it?
Well, not as a street activist, but as somebody who's on one of these boards appointed to help the bureaucracy decide how to spend its money. My view from that hat is that things are a lot worse, that there are growing of, this is publicly known and it's nationally true. The largest growing number of new people on welfare are children. Mm-hmm. And if you understand that most of the people that get welfare in the first place are kids,